Hello, my name is Norma Goodson, and I'd like to welcome you to this spring edition of the East Devon Talking Newspaper magazine, being recorded in the Dissenters Hall, Sidmouth. I said spring edition optimistically, after all the wet weather we've experienced recently. However, we've decided to look towards the summer and have included some nice items today centred on preparing for the spring and summer and what we hope will be the lovely warm weather ahead when we can all enjoy being outside again. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome your readers, Gerald Whedon, Anne-Marie Irish, Diana Crowther, Gillian Crooks and Geoffrey Ogden. Your producer today is Sam Clark, and the registrar is Wendy Eagles. Just for your information, your curtains can be open at any time after 6:25 a.m. and closed at any time before 8:04 p.m. If you have any problems with your equipment, please phone this mobile number, which is checked regularly. 07 55 27 66 382. We'll now move on to the new magazine for this spring season. To begin this edition in a slightly unusual way, do any of you recognise this group of girl singers? As I fade that out, it is, of course, the Vernon Girls, who are perhaps a forerunner to the modern-day Spice Girls. Now, at the start of this edition, we've managed to track down one of the original band members, Sheila Parker, who is now resident in Sidmouth. And earlier this week, Gillian visited her home and obtained an interview, which we hope you'll enjoy.
Hello, Sheila, and thank you for inviting me to your lovely home. You have had a fascinating career. Would you please summarise your career for our listeners?
Well, at the age of 15, I joined the Tiller Girls and I did two seasons, pantomimes. One was in Oxford, one was in Manchester. From then on, at the age of 16, I auditioned for the Vernon Girls, which meant I was on television every single week, the start of rock and roll with all these amazing pop stars. After that, when I got married, I joined the Palladium, and I was then living in London, and I worked at the Palladium with Cliff Richard as a pantomime and the Shadows, obviously. And then I did a review at the Palladium. Can I just say, I did this. I had my son in between these two shows. He was 5 months old and I went back to the Palladium doing two shows with Harry Secombe, Jimmy Tarbuck, Russ Conway. It was just amazing, but I don't know how I did it. It was such hard work. After that, I did a solo career working with a band, first of all, and then working all the Northern clubs. Before, gosh, well, it is 60 years I've been doing this. So we then reformed the Vernon Girls in 1989 when we were working at the Wembley Stadium with Cliff Richard's 30th anniversary. We met up with the rest of the girls and three of us decided to do the Vernon Girls again, which we did for 15 years. And I can't tell you the fun we had.
Oh, that was lovely. Thank you for that. And can you tell us about a career highlight?
A career highlight, it probably would be at the Wembley Stadium. Cliff Richard was celebrating his 30th anniversary in show business, and he decided the first half of it would be the O Boy Show, which we did in the 60s. So he brought in as many of the Vernon girls that could still wanted to do the show. There was 13 of us. And the Dallas Boys and the Shadows and Jerry and the Pacemakers and all the people from the 60s. And it was in front of 82,000 people. And when I tell you, the roar of the crowd when we went up on stage was unbelievable.
Wonderful. And do you still perform?
I still do talks. It's... I don't kick my legs high anymore, and I love to sing, and yes, I'm often asked to do a singing job. Unfortunately, it's been at funerals and weddings and things like that these days, but I do talks telling everybody about my career, and it does take me back to how I was then. I put my Vernon Girls hat on and I do my talks. Great fun.
Paul O'Grady called the Vernon Girls a forerunner to the Spice Girls. What's your opinion of modern music?
Oh, do you know what? Well, without being negative, no. There is some fabulous music. I mean, I adore Barbara Streisand, girls like that. I mean, there's some fabulous music. I can't stand rap. I went to see Hamilton and it's all rap and I couldn't understand a word that they were saying. But there is some wonderful musicians out there, and some Amy Whitehouse, you know, Whitney Houston. These girls are fabulous singers. I love it.
Can you tell us about an amusing incident during your career?
Well, I thought about this one. Now, when the Vernon Girls reformed, there was... two friends of mine, Linda and Nikki Stevens, who used to sing with Brotherhood of Man. And we reformed the Vernon Girls. This was in the 80s. We were booked to go to Spain, and it was fabulous. We performed at a club, the Casanovas, and we worked 5 days a week, but we had 2 days off. So this particular day, we said, let's all dress up and we'll go up into Calpe, the old town, which is lots of narrow streets with houses leaning into there. We went to this lovely pizza restaurant. We sat outside and there wasn't a table inside. And the owner said, just sit out there, girls, and when there's a table, I'll call you in. Well, we sat outside with several other tables, and my friend Nikki is Welsh. And unfortunately, or fortunately, there were some Welsh people on the other table. And we all started singing, we'll keep a welcome in the hillside. And a lady came out from the balcony overhead, and she, just next to this restaurant, she said, shh, please, my bambino, be quiet, be quiet. We said, okay. We sat down. Another couple of glasses of wine later, we were all singing, Land of Hope and Glory. And this bucket of water came over the three of us and we were soaking wet. I kid you not. We stood up and we said, honestly, we were dressed to the nines. We were soaking wet. And we said, you know, people have been paying good money to watch us the rest of the week, but this lady's just thrown a bucket of water over us. So I'll never forget that.
Would you do it all again?
What, the bucket of water?
No.
No. Do you know, when I look back, I wouldn't change a thing. I've had a fabulous life. I'm still having a wonderful life living in Devon here. I feel very fortunate. But when I look back, it was the time, and I say to all my friends, weren't we lucky to be born? I was born in the 40s. Lived through the 50s and the 60s. what a wonderful time it was. Yeah. It was really good.
Oh, well, thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Sheila, for telling us about your career. And we are very happy that you're now living with us in Devon.
So am I.
Hello, Geoffrey here. Staying on a theatrical theme, there's news of The War Horse. This wonderful play is touring the country again. We thought this gives us an ideal opportunity to look back at its history and the true events which inspired the creation of the film and play and book. The original War Horse novel was written by Devon-based author Michael Morpurgo, who was inspired to write the story after meeting World War I veterans at his local pub in Iddesleigh, mid-Devon. Filming took place on Dartmoor, predominantly around Meavy and Sheepstore, in August 2010, when director Steven Spielberg was quoted as saying of the area, "I've never before in my long and eclectic career been gifted with such an abundance of natural beauty as I experienced filming War Horse on Dartmoor. And with 2.5 weeks of extensive covering of landscapes and skies, I hardly scratched the surface of the visual opportunities that were offered to me." War Horse is a tale of loyalty, hope, and tenacity set against a sweeping canvas of rural England and Europe during the First World War. War Horse begins with a remarkable friendship between a horse named Joey and a young man named Albert, who tames and trains him. When they are forcefully parted, the film follows the extraordinary journey of the horse as he moves through the war, changing and inspiring the lives of all those he meets, British cavalry, German soldiers, and a French farmer, and his granddaughter before the story reaches its emotional climax in the heart of No Man's Land. The First World War is experienced through the journey of this horse, an odyssey of joy and sorrow, passionate friendship, and high adventure. War Horse is one of the great stories of friendship and war. A successful book, it was turned into a hugely successful international theatrical hit that is currently touring the UK. And now I'd like to turn to the true story. 8 million horses, donkeys and mules died in World War I, 3/4 of them from the extreme conditions they worked in. At the start of the war, the British Army had 25,000 horses, and another 115,000 were purchased compulsorily under the Horse Mobilisation Scheme. Over the course of the war, between 500 and 1,000 horses were shipped to Europe every day. This shortfall required the United States to help with remount efforts, even before it had formally entered the war. Between 1914 and 1918, the US sent almost 1 million horses overseas, and another 182,000 were taken overseas with American troops. Canada sent about 130,000 horses during World War I. By the end of the war, Canada had provided well over 10% of the horses used on the Western Front. 1/4 of all horse deaths were due to gunfire and gas. Exhaustion and disease claimed the rest. Many horses were initially used as traditional cavalry horses, but their vulnerability to modern machine guns and artillery fire meant their role changed to transporting troops and ammunition. Military vehicles were relatively new inventions and prone to problems. Horses and mules were more reliable and cheaper forms of transport. Thousands of horses pulled field guns, brought ammunition and supplies to the front lines, hauled feed, and carried battle casualties to field hospitals. Up to 12 horses were required to pull heavy artillery. The book Warrior, the amazing story of a real war horse, which was published in 1934, and the documentary War Horse, the Real Story, which was a TV movie in 2012, is the extraordinary and deeply moving story of a million British horses that served in World War I. The true story is more epic than the Spielberg feature film. It too is about the deep bond that develops between man and horse under very stressful conditions, a bond that helped both human and horse survive the hell of the Somme and Passchendaele. First published as My Horse Warrior by General Jack Seeley in 1934, Warrior was published again in 2011 and then in paperback in 2013 and 2014. Introduced by Seeley's grandson, writer and broadcaster Bruff Scott, it contains the original drawings and paintings by the famous equine and war artist Sir Alfred Munnings, painted of Warrior on the Western Front in 1918 and at home on the Isle of Wight after the war. Warrior is an amazing story, with all the more wondrous because it's true. Authored by Winston Churchill's heroic friend Jack Seeley, the book tells the story of the thoroughbred horse he took to France in 1914, surviving 5 years of bombs and bullets to lead a cavalry charge in 1918, before returning home, where they rode on together until 1938. Their combined ages totaled 100. The book tells the history of a warrior from his birth in an Isle of Wight field to his amazing life as a famous warhorse, and how a combination of the horse's extraordinary character and some unbelievable twists of fate helped him survive a war which claimed the lives of so many horses. The story begins with a mass call-up of horses from every farm and country estate in the land. Bruff Scott tells the tale of his aristocratic grandfather, General Jack Seeley, and his beloved horse warrior, who would become the most famous horse of the war, renowned for his amazing courage and a mascot to the troops. The British Army hoped its illustrious cavalry regiments would win a swift victory, but it would be years before they enjoyed their moment of glory. The heavy horses transporting guns, ammunition and food to the frontline troops tragically resulted in 250,000 deaths due to shrapnel wounds and disease. Behind the lines, an army of veterinarians worked miracles to treat injured horses and keep them going. The finest hour of the cavalry came on March the 30th, 1918, when Seeley, on his warhorse Warrior, and a number of Canadian regiments made one of history's last ever cavalry charges against the Germans near Amiens. They checked the German advance and helped win the war. Heartache for warhorses didn't end with the armistice. At war's end, 85,000 of the oldest were sold for horse meat to feed prisoners of war and starving citizens in France and Belgium. 500,000 horses were sold to French farmers to help rebuild the countryside. Only 60,000 made it back to Britain. Six black horses that survived the war together, they would pull the body of the unknown warrior to its last resting place in Westminster Abbey. But the most famous war horse of all to return in glory was Warrior. His story, like the million other British horses who served, should never be forgotten. Warrior was a small, sturdy bay thoroughbred born in April 1908, a couple of miles from General Jack Seeley's home on the Isle of Wight, cheated death for 5 years. With his bold head and fearless eye, he became a symbol of indomitability. By then, they said, the bullet had not been made that could finish Warrior. And when he died in 1941, at the grand age of 33, he was granted an unprecedented obituary in the Times under the title, The Horse the Germans Could Not Kill. His escapes were quite wonderful, and again he survived when death seemed certain, and indeed befell all his neighbours. It was not all hazard, sometimes it was due to his intelligence. I have seen him, even when a shell has burst, within a few feet standing still without a tremor, just turn his head and unconcerned look at the smoke of the burst. General Jack Seeley. I'm now going to hand over to Gillian, who will read what we hope will become an amusing feature of this magazine, the challenges faced by being a member of the clergy, from the vicar of the imaginary church St. James the Least of all, to his nephew Darren, the vicar of a very modern church. And so it's over to Gillian.
St. James the Least of all, on the delights of the parish jumble sale. My dear nephew Darren, the estimate for rehanging the bells in our church tower came as a great shock. The church council discussed fundraising at length. Someone suggested selling part of the rectory garden for building, another for getting 200 parishioners to loan £1,000 each, interest-free. Then Mrs. French suggested holding a jumble sale. The jumble sale won, mainly because it was achievable without a great fight, and also gave everyone an opportunity to see what their neighbours think of as junk. Expensive articles were brought with an ostentatious show of modesty when everyone was sorting donations. Genuine jumbles such as old plates, old blankets, and mysterious kitchen gadgets were left at the church door in the dead of night. On the day of the jumble sale, our helpers were ready behind wobbly tables stacked high with stuff. Had the table collapsed, half the congregation would have been smothered. Little Miss Faversham was having a wonderful time, flitting from table to table like a woolly bumblebee, kitting herself out for another year. When the doors opened and the customers poured in, I realised how Italians must have felt when they saw Hannibal with his elephants pouring down the sides of the Alps. That is when the mettle of our ladies really showed. They were tremendous, haggling at great length over whether something worth £10 should go for 10p or 11p. I noticed that those who are used to riding with hounds seemed better able to control the crowds, even if they occasionally tended to regard the customers as the fox. As it happened, the youth club were going potholing that day, so most of the teenagers bought complete sets of clothing for 10p, which could then be discarded afterwards. But I wondered what their caving instructor would think of teenagers arriving dressed in dinner jackets and tweed skirts. 2 days of preparation yielded a battle that was over in less than an hour. We emerged blooded but unbowed, with only scraps of jumble left. Then it was home for a bath and a strong restorative, in the knowledge that the first step to saving the bells had been taken. Only another 2,500 jumble sales and we shall have reached our target. Indeed, the only jarring note of the day was to discover someone with a peculiar sense of humour who put a note on my car, sold to be collected later. Your loving uncle, Eustace. You may feel in need of a little light refreshment now, so I'm going to hand over to Gerald, and she will tell us how to make a delicious drink to get through the summer, together with some very special cakes.
Hello, Gerald here. Here are some instructions for how to make elderflower cordial. Ingredients: a heaped teaspoon of citric acid, 2 pounds of white sugar, 2 lemons, 1 orange, 25 fresh elderflower heads, de-stalked. During picking, make sure to check the flower heads for insects, which you can remove and put back on the tree. Method: pare the zest from the lemons and orange, then slice the fruit, removing pips. Mix the sugar with 2.5 pints of water in a large saucepan. Gently heat to dissolve the sugar. Once the sugar is dissolved, bring the pan of syrup to the boil and remove from the heat. Add the elderflower heads along with the lemon and orange slices, zest and citric acid. Then stir well. Cover the pan and infuse for 24 hours. Strain the liquid through a muslin cloth or a colander lined with a clean tea towel, allowing it to slowly drip into a bowl. Once it has all suffused, discard the remains and decant into sterilised sealable bottles. It'll last for 6 weeks in the fridge and can also be frozen. And now, if you want something to eat, how about rout cakes, spelt R-O-U-T cakes. These little delicious cakes were served at Regency routs or picnics. Routs were large, crowded evening parties at country houses where refreshments and music were provided, but little else, often not even chairs. Guests would mill around in all the rooms, which had been stripped of carpets and furniture for the occasion, meeting people and socialising. If nothing else, routs provided plenty of topics for the ensuing gossip and rumours that followed these gatherings. Contemporary recipes often use brandy and sweet wine, orange blossom water and rose water. These last two were popular flavourings and gorgeously scented. The orange blossom water enhances the fruit beautifully, and a little rose water is nice, but only use a couple of drops as it is extremely strong. Regency rout cakes would not have contained any raising agents as they were yet to be invented, but they do make the cakes lovely and light. In Jane Austen's Emma, the annoying Mrs. Elton was a little shocked at an evening function by the poor attempt at rout cakes. As they are so simple to make, it's very hard indeed to imagine any country house cook of the time making a poor attempt at them. Ingredients: a tablespoon of brandy, 50 grams of mixed dried fruit and peel, 110 grams of plain flour, 1 teaspoon of cream of tartar, 1/2 teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda, 50 grams of salted butter diced, 50 grams of golden caster sugar, 1 medium egg, 1 teaspoon of orange blossom water, 1 couple of drops of rose water. Method: you will need a large baking tray, greased or lined with greaseproof paper. Preheat the oven to 180 degrees Celsius for a fan oven, 200 degrees Celsius for a non-fan oven, gas mark 6 or equivalent. Stir the flour and raising agents together and rub in the butter. Stir in the sugar, fruit and brandy. Whisk the egg well and stir into the mix with the orange blossom water and rose water. For ease of handling, flour your hands and transfer to a lightly floured board. Roll it around very lightly and, using 2 teaspoons, space out little piles of mixture on the baking tray. Sometimes the mixture is a bit sticky, so you may need to use clean teaspoons halfway. Bake for 10 minutes or until golden. Be careful not to overbake. Cool on a wire tray. Well, after all that activity, we're now going to go for a complete change of tone and take a little time to pause and reflect as we move into spring.
Nothing is so beautiful as spring, when weeds and wheels shoot long and lovely and lush. Thrush's eggs look little low heavens, and thrush through the echoing timber does so rinse and ring the ear, it strikes like lightnings to hear him sing. The glassy pear tree leaves and blooms, they brush the descending blue. That blue is all in a rush with richness. The racing lambs too have fair their fling. What is all this juice and all this joy? A strain of the earth's sweet being in the beginning in Eden's garden. Have, get, before it cloy, before it cloud, Christ, Lord and sour with sinning, innocent mind and mayday in girl and boy. Most, O maid's child, thy choice, and worthy the winning.
This is Gillian again, reading about a sensory garden. Written in May 1877, but unpublished until 1918, Gerald Manley Hopkins' sonnet Spring captures a season of rebirth as perfectly today as it did then. Indeed, spring has a way of bringing us joy and enlivening our senses and our thoughts. They often turn to great outdoors. Sensory gardens offer a unique and enchanting way to experience nature and engage the senses, especially for those of us who are visually impaired. According to Jackie Carroll of GardeningKnowHow.com, a sensory garden is one that appeals to all the senses without overwhelming them. Garden plants include those that can be touched, smelled, tasted, or even heard. Here are some important considerations. Safety. Safety and easy navigation are critical when designing a garden. Carroll recommends garden design include straight pathways and landmarks, changes in walkway texture. Railings, says Carroll, should accompany any change in topography and begin a few feet before inclines or declines. When selecting plants for the garden, avoid prickly or thorny bushes and flowers. Poisonous plants should also be avoided, since they could be accidentally ingested or cause reaction, such as poison ivy and poison oak. smell. It goes without saying that fragrance is a critically important aspect of sensory gardens, but it's important to choose scents carefully. Overpowering fragrances may be unpleasant for persons with a heightened sensitivity to odours. Used selectively, fragrance helps people to find their way around the garden and, of course, provides a pleasurable experience. Planet Natural suggests a combination of scents that range from subtle to more intense to produce the greatest variety and interest. Plants to consider for their scent include honeysuckle, lavender, violets, mint, and chocolate cosmos, which releases a chocolate-like scent. Sound. Incorporate auditory elements in the sensory garden with wind chimes and water features, such as trickling fountains and bird baths that attract the lovely sound of chirping birds. Master gardener Susan Patterson suggests choosing plant flora that makes noise when the wind passes through them, such as bamboo stems. Many seed pods make interesting sounds as well, and the end of season leaves a fun crunching sound under feet, adds Patterson. You can also include plants that encourage wildlife in the garden. The buzzing of a bee, the chirping of a cricket, or the whizzing of a hummingbird all stimulates the sense of hearing. Touch. Sensory gardens offer a wonderful opportunity for tactile exploration. Plants and flowers with interesting textures include pussy willow, woolly thyme, chenille, and hyacinth. Some plants, such as scented geranium, release their scents when they are touched. For example, geraniums, lemon balm, and mint. Taste. Edible flowers add another sensory dimension to the garden. Examples from Planet Natural include nasturtiums, evening primrose, hibiscus, and pansy. Berries, fruit trees, vegetables, herbs, and spices are another great addition. When planting edible flowers, fruit, herbs, and spices, take care to place them in an area that's distinct from the rest of the garden. We all hope you can enjoy a garden this summer. And staying on our garden theme, I would like to introduce you to Anne-Marie, who is going to share her personal thoughts on the swift, which is a regular feature in our East Devon gardens. Anne-Marie.
Because it is spring, I have been thinking about swifts. In 2019, I was working for the Royal Albert Memorial Museum in Exeter. It was our year of migration, and one of the temporary exhibitions was Birds Without Borders. Inside a glass display case was a little sooty brown swift. I have a poignant memory of first noticing that bird, its compact body, enfolded by scythe-shaped wings, was about the length of my hand. There was a short forked tail and barely visible feet. Standing alongside our visitors, we shared our feelings about seeing the swift there, out of its element. We also marveled at the incredible feat of migration that swifts achieved in order to survive. Now it is April, and towards the end of this month and early in May, the swifts will be arriving from Africa, where they have spent winter. They come to nest amongst us in the high, obscure places of our cities, towns, and villages. By mid-August, they are gone again. Swifts announce themselves with a screeching call that is not unlike a rusty bicycle brake. Our ancestors called them screech martins and screamers. The naturalist, poet, and author Helen MacDonald writes of swifts in her book, Vesper Flights. Swifts are magical in the manner of all things that exist, just a little beyond understanding. Once they were called devil birds, perhaps because those screaming flocks of black crosses around churches seemed pulled from darkness, not to light. but to me, they are creatures of the upper air, and of their nature, unintelligible, which makes them more akin to angels. Unlike all other birds, they never descend to the ground. As a bird-obsessed child, I was frustrated that there was no way for me to know them better. They were so fast, it was impossible to focus on their facial expressions or watch them preen through binoculars. They were only ever flickering silhouettes at 20, 30, 40 miles an hour. A shoal of birds, a pouring sheaf of identical black grains against bright clouds. Sometimes, if the swifts were flying low over rooftops, I'd see one open its mouth, and that was truly uncanny, because the gape was huge, turning the bird into something uncomfortably like a miniature basking shark. Swifts are the undisputed masters of the air. Their flight is fast and powerful, or long-winged and whirling. They are airborne sickles. Swifts spend their entire lives on the wing, feeding, drinking, and even mating. They pair for life, only landing to nest. What is beyond my comprehension is their vesper flights. Each evening, swifts rise up thousands of feet to above the clouds, where they are no longer visible to us. There they sleep and orientate themselves using wind, stars, and polarizing light patterns. They are calibrating their magnetic compasses. Helen MacDonald, writing again in her book, "For years, we thought vesper flights were simply swifts flying higher up to sleep on the wind. Like other birds, they can close one eye and put half of their brain to sleep, with the other half awake and the other eye open for flight. But it's likely that swifts properly sleep up there too, drift into REM states where both eyes are closed and flying is automatic, at least for short periods. During the First World War, a French aviator on special night operations cut his engine at 10,000 feet and glided down in silent, close circles over enemy lines. A light wind against him, the full moon overhead. "We suddenly found ourselves," he wrote, "among a strange flight of birds, which seemed to be motionless, or at least showed no noticeable reaction. They were widely scattered and only a few yards below the aircraft, showing up against a white sea of cloud underneath." He had flown into a small party of swifts in deep sleep, miniature black stars illuminated by the reflected light of the moon. The remote air, the coldness, the stillness, and the high birds over white cloud, suspended in sleep. It's an image that drifts in and out of my dreams.
Thank you so much, Anna-Marie, for your sharing your thoughts and feelings. Hello, everyone. My name is Diana Crowther. I, like many people, love gardening, but one of my great interests is sport, and I'm very happy to be your designated sports correspondent for this edition. I've selected a few articles about local sport for you, and I hope this will interest you. Here we go. Seaton Tennis Club starts a new era with a new coach. Seton Tennis welcomed a new coach, Joe Waters, at the beginning of November. Joe comes with great credentials from his previous clubs in Gloucestershire. In addition to his coaching programme, he's been joining in at club sessions and getting to know everyone. He's also bolstered our A team by playing some local league fixtures, a very welcome addition to the squad. Joe said, "The first month here at Seton has been fantastic. Everyone has been really welcoming and supportive. Getting the junior section running alongside an already strong adult membership." Dave Wraith, club membership secretary and already a regular client of Joe's, added, "It's great to have Joe at the club, and I'm sure my game is improving as a result. I've already enjoyed trying cardio tennis in particular. It's great fun hitting with softer balls, and you can get a brilliant workout at the same time. Everyone is really enjoying it, no matter what level they are at." Sidmouth Surf Life Saving Club. Sidmouth Surf Life Saving Club youth team, 15 to 17 years, took a small team of 10 to the annual Devon Surf Life Saving Pool Championships held in a 50-metre pool at Mount Kelly School in Tavistock. The first time the club athletes have competed in a 50-metre pool. Competing against all Devon clubs, Sidmouth had some fantastic results with outstanding individual performances. Sidmouth was placed fourth overall against much larger teams and came home with 6 individual medals, 3 gold, 3 silver, and 2 further team medals, 1 silver and 1 bronze. Another amazing result from the Sidmouth Life Surf Rescue Team, and a reward for all the hard work behind the scenes from coaches, volunteers, and young participants. Axcliffe Golfers, back on course after wet weather. Firstly, the ladies were able at last to enjoy a dry and sunny Wednesday when they organised a friendly bring and win competition. Not surprisingly, many were rusty getting into the swing again, and with one lovely lady stating she felt like a 4-year-old waving a plastic sword around. Amy Rodericks won the day with the most Stapleford points, helped by couples of pairs and a bogey. Well played, Amy. The men's section also had a wonderful sunny day to finish the week on Mothering Sunday and in another round of their winter league competition. The Gate family of Dad John and son Billy were worthy winners with a net 60. The club has also presented a cheque for £409 to guide dogs for the blind, the cause nominated for the club's fundraising charity by last year's senior captain, Stephen Thompson. The cheque was received by Lena Welsh, who is slightly sight impaired herself, and has volunteered for the charity since 2008 because of her personal life-changing experience of having a guide dog. She is now the coordinator of the charity's East Devon fundraising group. Also in attendance was Jeff Chappell, a puppy raiser for the charity, with his young dog Ozzy. Lena has had guide dogs since 2008 and is passionate about the charity's work. Her current dog is her 4th, and her previous dogs have had to retire. The star signing for Sidmouth Cricket Club. South African all-rounder Andile Mogokane has signed for Sidmouth Cricket Club ahead of the new season in Tolchard Devon Cricket League. Mogokane, 24, was a tremendous prospect as a youngster in his home country, starring for South Africa under-19s and the emerging players squad. He arrives at Fortfield under recommendation from Bryce Parsons, the South African star at Sidmouth last summer, and it was a big blow when he left with 5 games to go. It is hoped that Mogokane will make a similar impact which would be very exciting. Sidmouth begin their season on the 4th of May with a visit from Exeter, and they will travel to Exmouth for the East Devon Derby on the 8th of June.
And now I want to turn away from sport and think about some of what can be even more energetic companions in our lives, our pets. Particularly with the onset of the summer months and hopefully some warm days, it does no harm to remind ourselves of the extra care we must take of our pets, especially our dogs. We hope that they can enjoy the warmer weather too. Dog care in summer. Here are some steps you can take to ensure your dog stays cool during the summer months. Never leave dogs in hot cars, conservatories, outbuildings or caravans on a warm day, even if only for a short while. When it's 22 degrees C outside, temperatures can quickly rise to 47 degrees C, 117 degrees Fahrenheit in these environments, which can be fatal. Use PetSafe sun cream on exposed parts of your pet's skin, such as the tips of their ears and nose, to avoid sunburn. This is especially important if your dog has white or light-coloured fur, as they can be very vulnerable of getting burnt. If you're unsure which is the right product to use, please ask your vet. Ensure pets always have access to shade and fresh drinking water to help keep them cool. Check every day for fly strike. This can be fatal. Put ice cubes into your dog's water bowl or make some tasty ice cube treats. You could also freeze a Kong with treats and water. Give your pet damp towels to lie on. Never place a damp towel over your dog, as this can trap in heat, or an ice pack wrapped in a towel. Both simple methods could provide welcome relief from the heat. If you're planning a day out with your dog, check before leaving home whether dogs are allowed. If they're not, arrange a pet sitter or choose another dog-friendly attraction. Groom them regularly. Regular grooming in warmer weather can help brush away any dead or excess hair, leaving your dog with a less dense coat, much better for staying cool. Dogs may also appreciate a paddling pool to splash around in, although not all dogs like water, so there's no need to force them if they don't want to. Walking your dog in hot weather. Dogs need exercise even when it's hot. We recommend walking your dog in the morning or evening when it's cooler to reduce the risk of heat stroke and burning their paws on the pavement. Do you know the signs of heat stroke and what to do if you spot them? Signs of burned pads. Try the 5-second test. If it's too hot for your hands, it's too hot for paws. You can also look out for limping or refusing to walk, licking or chewing at their feet, pads darker in colour, missing part of the pad, blisters or redness, signs of heat stroke, heavy panting and difficulty breathing, excessively drooling, the dog appears lethargic, drowsy or uncoordinated, collapsed or vomiting. If you suspect your dog has the signs of heat stroke, you must act quickly. Following these simple guidelines will keep your dog happy and healthy throughout the summer months. Enjoy your time together.
Hello, it's Gerald here again. Thank you, Sam, for reading about looking after pets. But I now want to remind ourselves how to look after ourselves this summer. My article is called Staying Safe and Well This Summer. Heatwave advice. When we get to the summer, most of us look forward to the hot weather. Some of us can find the heat uncomfortable and even experience sunburn, heat stroke, and bites from insects that proliferate during warmer weather. You can avoid feeling uncomfortable or unwell by making sure you're prepared for summer. Heat affects everyone. For some people in particular, the very young, the elderly, and those who have chronic or severe illness, the health risks can be increased. Prolonged hot weather can exacerbate heart and breathing problems, cause dehydration, increase the risks of fainting or falling, or worsen the symptoms of asthma. Everyone can be affected by high temperatures, but there are certain factors that increase an individual's risk during a heat wave. For example, those exposed to the sun for long periods, such as outdoor workers and the homeless, and people living in top floor flats. Some of the signs of heat-related harm include feeling dizzy, weak, or having an intense thirst and headache. Move to a cool place as soon as possible. Drink some water or diluted fruit juice to rehydrate, and avoid excess alcohol. Painful muscular spasms, particularly in the legs, arms, or abdomen, for example, after sustained exercise during very hot weather. Rest immediately in a cool place and drink electrolyte drinks. Most people should start to recover within 30 minutes, and if not, they should seek medical help. Call 111 if you feel unusual symptoms or if symptoms persist. Call 999 if a person develops any signs of heat stroke, as this is a medical emergency. Here are a few tips to keep you cool and well. Stay hydrated with water. Keep out of the sun between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. If you have to go out, cover your head with a hat, preferably with a wide brim or a scarf. Wear light, loose clothing and choose light-coloured clothes. Apply and reapply sunscreen with a high SPF to protect you from harmful UVB and UVA rays. Take water with you when travelling. Limit alcohol as it increases dehydration. Close curtains on the sunny sides so you avoid the hot sun. Open the windows in the evening if safe to do so when it's cool. Avoid extreme physical exertion. Remember to drink lots of water when active. Make sure babies do not overheat. Keep them in light clothing. Avoid wrapping them in heavy blankets. If you have an elderly neighbour, check they are okay. Do not leave pets, children, or older people in cars or conservatories, which can overheat quickly. Keep a check on the weather. The Met Office has up-to-date weather forecasts. NHS Choices provides a lot of helpful advice and further information on how to be prepared during a heat wave, who's most at risk, and what to do if someone feels unwell.
It's Geoffrey here again. We're still on the subject of staying safe, and as we're all fortunate enough to live near the sea, it would be totally remiss of us to miss out this article about an important event in the history of the RNOI. The Duke of Kent attends a service of thanksgiving on the 200th anniversary of the RNLI. The Duke of Kent has attended a special service of thanksgiving at Westminster Abbey as the Royal National Lifeboat Institution celebrates 200 years of saving lives at sea. Representatives from RNLI life-saving communities, along with the display of historic and modern lifeboats, attended a service of thanksgiving with the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Duke of Kent leading the celebrations in Westminster Abbey. Queen Elizabeth II became patron of the RNLI in 1952, the same year she became Queen. At this time, the Duke of Kent's mother, Princess Marina, was president of the charity, a role which her son took over in 1969. During his time as president, the Duke has visited the vast majority of the RNLI's lifeboat stations and has paid many repeat visits. Vice Admiral Sir Timothy Lawrence, husband of the Princess Royal, was also in attendance at the service of thanksgiving. The Duke of Kent met volunteers and workers at the charity and inspected three lifeboats, including the William Riley, an oar-powered boat built in 1909, a D-class lifeboat, and a modern Shannon-class boat. An added cause for celebration was that UNESCO has confirmed it will endorse the life-saving charity's 200th anniversary because of the RNLI's international reach and recognition and how it reflects the ideas, values and cultural diversity of UNESCO. The RNLI has been saving lives at sea since it was founded on the 4th of March 1824. Today the charity operates 238 lifeboat stations around the UK and Ireland, including four on the River Thames, and has seasonal lifeguards on over 240 beaches around the UK. It designs and builds its own lifeboats, and it runs domestic and international water safety programmes. Since it was founded in 1824, its lifeboat crews and lifeguards have saved over 144,000 lives. The UK delegation to UNESCO, part of the UK's Foreign Office, and the UK National Commission for UNESCO proposed the RNLI's 200th anniversary be recognised. The proposal received support from UNESCO delegations of Ireland, Tanzania and Bangladesh. This means the 200th anniversary of the RNLI is now included in the list of global anniversaries that UNESCO will officially be associated with in 2024-25. The organisations will work closely through 2024 on a range of domestic and international opportunities, such as working with UNESCO designations, including World Heritage Sites, Biosphere Reserves, Creative Cities and Global Geoparks across the UK and overseas to help promote drowning prevention messages. RNLI Chief Executive Mark Dowie says, "It's an immense honour for the RNLI's 200 years of life-saving to be recognised by an organisation with such global significance as UNESCO. For two centuries, the RNLI has continued to save lives thanks to the commitment of its people, its lifesavers and supporters. And so this recognition is really a tribute to their courage, dependability and generosity, which have made the charity into the world-class life-saving organisation it is today."
It's Diana again. For our penultimate article, we turn to the work of an inspiring young lady, Lucy Edwards, who I heard about quite recently when I heard her interviewed about her book. At only 27 years old, she's had an impressive list of achievements. We hope to make this a regular article, like those about our vicar, but only this slot will be about inspiring individuals who've overcome adversity. Anne-Marie and I will now read to you about her. Lucy Edwards is a broadcaster, journalist, content creator, speaker, and disability activist, and is an absolute force to be reckoned with. After losing her full eyesight at only 17 to a rare genetic disease named incontinentia pigmenti, Lucy had no one to look up to that was going through the same thing, and it made her mission to share her experiences with the world. Through her infectious personality and her open commentary on life, Lucy has amassed an incredible combined social media following over 2.8 million. Her global audience has viewed Lucy's content over 1 billion times and counting, and has placed her as one of the leading voices in the diversity, equality, and inclusion space worldwide. Launching her successful career with the BBC in 2017 at just 20, Lucy produced content for Ouch Disability Talk, BBC Four's In Touch, and BBC News Online. By 2019, she broke new ground as a first blind presenter to host several shows on the BBC Radio 1. Lucy's career has since expanded to including presenting documentaries for the BBC Travel Show, along with hosting panels, keynote speeches and workshops for international brands, charities, media conglomerates and corporate events. Her work earned her a Royal Television Society Award for her travel show documentary on Kenyan safari, Notably, in June 2022, she shared her story of resilience at the Brilliant Minds Conference in Stockholm, sharing the stage with Malala, Alicia Keys, and Naomi Campbell. In March 2024, she hosted Apple's first ever accessibility panel at the SXSW, interviewing Sarah Herlinger, the Global Accessibility Lead, and won the RTS Breakthrough Presenter Award for her documentary, Japan, The Way I See It.
In October 2021, Lucy became an ambassador and commercial model for the global hair care giant Pantene, becoming the face with iconic red hair for their 2022 and 2023 Silky and Glowing and Miracles Colour Gloss campaigns. These product lines are the first to print packaging to include the trailblazing technology NaviLens, a QR-style code which can be scanned with a smartphone, making packaging accessible for the blind and visually impaired consumer. A testament to Lucy's leadership in advocating for universal design. Her collaboration with Procter & Gamble as their disability partner in 2024 further highlights her commitment to developing inclusive practices. Lucy's book, Blind Not Broken, released in March 2024 with Octopus Publishing, is groundbreaking. It not only features Braille on its cover, but also integrates NaviLens technology, ensuring accessibility for all readers. This initiative is driven by Lucy's passion for making literature accessible, a desire rooted in her childhood experiences. Lucy's daily efforts are dedicated to those who, like her younger self, lacked role models. She strives for a world where diversity is celebrated and disability is recognised as a normal aspect of life. Underpinning her work is the belief in the social model of disability. It is society that needs to adapt, not the individuals with disabilities. Lucy's life motto, Blind Not Broken, encapsulates her philosophy and her unwavering commitment to change.
Hello, Gillian here again. Now for our final article, which we hope will make you smile. We're still following through with the twin themes of spring and summer, which of course bring us to the blooming of beautiful flowers. What better way to finish than with a famous monologue by Joyce Grenfell entitled Flowers? Please relax and enjoy. In this monologue, a teacher is trying to conduct a moving to movement class with various levels of cooperation from the pupils. Flowers. Children, we're going to do our nice moving to music this morning. So let's make a lovely fairy ring, shall we? And then we'll all be flowers growing in the grass. Let's make a big circle. Spread out, wider, wider, just fingertips touching. That's it. So let go of Neville. Because flowers don't hold hands, they just touch fingertips. So let go of Neville. And so we don't want grumblers in our fairy ring, do we? We only want smilers. Yes, David, you're a smiler, and so is Lavinia. Yes, and Peggy and Geoffrey, you're all smilers. Quiet, please. Don't get so excited. And Sue is going to be a smiler too, aren't you, Sue? That's better. George, don't do that. Now then, let's put our thinking caps on, shall we, and think what flowers we're going to be. Lavinia, what flower are you? A bluebell, oh good. Peggy, a red rose, that's nice. Neville, a wild rose, well done, Neville. Sydney? Sydney, pay attention, dear, and don't pummel Rosemary. What flower are you going to choose to be? A horse isn't a flower, Sydney. No, children, it isn't funny. It's silly. If Sydney can't think of a better flower than that, we'll have to go on to someone else until he can. Now then, Sue, what are you? Another rose. Oh, I have got a lovely bunch of roses, haven't I? Peggy is a red one, and Neville is a wild one, so I expect you are a beautiful white one, aren't you? Oh, you're another red one, I see. Now then, Sydney. A carrot isn't a flower, Sydney. Think, dear, and don't blow like that. How about a tulip? A holly leaf isn't a flower, Sydney. All right, you better be a holly leaf. Now, children, listen very carefully. Elvis, stop bouncing, please. No, bouncing isn't dancing, Elvis. Don't argue, dear. Just stop bouncing. You watch the others, you see. When Miss Bolting plays her music, I want you to all get up onto the topmost toes, light as feathers, and dance away all over the room, wherever the music takes you. And remember, you are all lovely flowers in the grass. Everybody ready? Just a minute, Miss Bolting. Sydney, come here, please. What have you got in your mouth? I can't hear a word you're saying, Sydney. So go out of the room and spit it out, whatever it is, and then come back and tell me what it was. And Sydney, both feet, don't hop. Now then, children, we're not going to wait for a boy who puts things in his mouth like a baby. We're going to be lovely flowers growing in the grass, and the sun is shining down on us to make us all grow tall and beautiful. And, Geoffrey, stand up. Flowers don't look backwards through their legs, do they? What flower are you? A fat daisy. Oh, good. Hazel, what do we do with our heads? We hold them up. I should think so. Come in, Sydney. Come in. There's no need to knock the door down, is there? Now, what did you have in your mouth? It can't have been nothing, Sydney, because I distinctly saw something. Yes, I know it's nothing now, but what was it then? A big button. Well, I'm very glad you spat it out, didn't you? You didn't. Do you feel all right, Sydney? Sure. Well, get back into your place then. Incidentally, where did you get the button? Off Rosemary's pink frock. I'm ashamed of you, Sydney, a big boy of four to go around eating buttons off little girls' frocks. What flower are you going to be? I've forgotten. You better be a hollyhock. No, you can't be a superjet. And if you're going to be a crosspatch, you better go and sit down over there till you are a nice boy again. You can't be thinking what flower you're going to be. Go along. George, what did I say before? Well, don't. Come along, children. Listen carefully to the music and then dance like a flower to it. We're ready at last, Miss Bolting. I'm sorry. One, two, off we go. Dance, Neville, don't just stand there, dance. Head up, Hazel, and use your arms. Peggy, dear, don't forget to breathe. Rhythm, George, and cheer up. You're a happy flower, George. Yes, you are, because I say so. Oh, good, Sydney, I think you knew you'd think of something. All right, you shall be a cauliflower. Only be it gently.
Now we come to the end of this edition of the magazine. We thank the readers and the contributors to this edition. Just a polite reminder to return your pouch to us. There is also a website where this recording can be heard, www.eastdevontalkingnewspaper.co.uk. The next magazine is due to be recorded on the 4th of July. Until then, it's goodbye from the Dissenters Hall, Sidmouth. We'll leave you, as we began, with a track from the Vernon Girls.
Don't you know I'm dying? Don't leave me in